KSDUT 90.3 FM. Elizabeth and I are here today. Joanne is programming for us, operating for us, and Danielle Como is here to talk about disco music and pop culture and lesbians. She's a graduate student in communications, disco fan, multimedia, and video producer. Can I add anything to that?
No, just that sounds like me.
It is. It sort of sums things up.
It certainly does.
we're going to try to do this in a pretty organized fashion. We've got an hour to talk about it. There's a lot to talk about, and there's a lot of tangents that one could get off on. So we're going to try to be fairly structured so we don't confuse people. That's the idea.
Yes.
We want to get things across. So I think we'll start chronologically. Origins of disco music.
Well, from a historical point of view, there are a number of ways that you can look at where disco music came out of. In terms of its musical tradition, it comes out of the late 60s in terms of a lot of black and Latin music that was not popular at the times in terms of mass popularity, but was very prominent in things like boogaloo clubs and that sort of thing. And by the late 60s, you saw music emerging, people like Sly Stone doing really dance-oriented funk music. And I guess disco music really comes out of that black funk tradition mixed with some Latin rhythms and percussion. So that by, I think it's 1968, 69, you have Family Affair, which is probably the first proto-disco hit. It's this funky tune with a dance groove. And the first song we'll be playing tonight is a recent remake of that song by B.E.F., sung by Lala Hathaway, and it's a remake of Family Affair. So you see this sort of full circle mm-hmm. as far as dance music goes, the sort of one of the first, what you might call disco songs, coming back in 1991. And there's been a number of remakes of Sly Stone's stuff sung by women now in 1991, Aretha Franklin's remake of Everyday People
right.
and Family Affair.
So strictly speaking, it's sort of from the funk, Sly Stone is... we would call it funk, right?
Mm-hmm. Oh,
sort
definitely.
Late 60s.
Yeah, late 60s funk.
So that's happening in conjunction with the whole hippie thing.
Actually, it's happening sort of beneath that whole very white, middle-class, hippie, movement or mm-hmm. phenomena, where it was very rock-oriented. The whole hippie thing was really rock-oriented and that very...
rock folk.
And not oriented towards dancing either. I mean, right. rock music was, you know, much more something you went to see live, and you sort of, if you did sort of move during the concert, it wasn't the kind of concentrated dancing that happens in dance clubs. So it was happening beneath that. It was happening more mm-hmm. more at an urban and, at that point, a bit more underground level than what you saw, all the popular rock music in the late 60s.
Were there specific cities that it was happening in more?
Well, particularly East Coast urban centers like New York City or Philadelphia, even places like New Jersey, you know, any big urban center where you had a mixing of Latin, black, and gay subcultures. You saw, you know, people getting together in nightclubs dancing, and the music of choice was black and Latin dance music,
because it is interesting, you know, when people talk about an era, often it's sort of summed up. The 60s is often summed up as the hippie movement, without much regard for anything else that happened.
Well, there was all kinds of other things mm-hmm. happening at the time. I mean, but what we're talking about in the late 60s is this massive youth movement that was, I mean, that yet massive youth movement was primarily white and middle class, and I mean, that was the baby boom. I mean, there was this
right.
big, you know, sort of blip of people, but there were all kinds of other things happening at the time that weren't directly associated with this white youth movement, and that is what black people were big consumers of pop music, consumers of music, and I think what happens in the 70s is that the music industry clues into this. And clues into the fact that this is huge urban demographic that consumes an incredible amount of music, and started directing more of the music towards them in terms of selling music, and that's probably one of the reasons why disco became so popular in the 70s. Is that there was a big record slump in the early 70s as well with the OPEC crisis, and there was a vinyl shortage as a result of the OPEC crisis. So there was this big slump in the music industry, and one of the ways they got out of that was realizing that there was this untapped demographic of urban blacks, Latins, gays, that sort of demographic that consumed a lot of music, and that where music was a really important part of the culture.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, their lives and mm-hmm. what they did for entertainment. Also, I mean, as producers of the music as well, blacks and Hispanics, and that translated into being appropriated by, I guess, the white music industry.
Well, it's kind of...
Is it?
I wouldn't make a blanket statement about the white music industry as opposed to black and Latin musical forms. I think it's there's all sorts of different kinds of negotiations going on there, mm. and that one thing you could say about disco, it was one of the first since the 20s, and earlier blues and jazz. It was one of the first, especially 50s rock and roll too. It's one of the first truly interracial musical forms at the level of production and performance, where you mm. saw racially mixed bands and at the level of production too, a lot of Latins and black people getting into the production of the music. So, I think it was 1975. Casey and the Sunshine Band, a racially mixed band, having the Hot 100 number one, as well as the Hot Soul number one. And disco music was one of the mm-hmm. first forms of music that was able to, since rock and roll, was able to have like the number one soul song and the number one Billboard Hot 100 song at the same time. So it was at the level of the music itself, it was interracial because it mixed together both white and black musical traditions. And at the performance level, you saw, you know, Latins and blacks and whites on the same stage performing together. So in that way, I think it's really important. And I think part of the backlash that came against disco in the late 70s, the whole disco sucks yeah. movement, was really, I think, a reaction to the fact that this music was really very much... a product of a black, gay, Latin, a very urban experience.
It was sexual too.
And of course, and it was mm. just absolutely frolicking with sexuality. I mean, it was the most, not the content, at the level of the content of the lyrics, but the structure of the music itself was incredibly sexual, and that's what made it so great to dance to, and that's what made it so incredibly fun to dance to at 5 o'clock in the morning in a discotheque when you're really tired and you're surrounded by half-naked, sweaty bodies, and you have these songs that... go on and on and on, and from a sort of just the structure of the music itself, there's really no closure. In the traditional pop song, you have this sort of beginning, middle, end structure to the music, and disco music, like the Family Affair song we're going to hear soon, and the say the Village People song we're going to hear later on, there is really no closure. It just builds and builds and builds, and in that, it's just the very structure of the music itself. It's incredibly sexual. Never mind, you know, the lyrics, you know, like you know, Donna Summer, "Love to Love You, Baby," which just is, you know, the most obvious "come fuck me" song, and you hear her in the background having orgasm after orgasm. So it's pretty hot stuff. It's pretty hot in here now.
Well, we'll go to a musical break then, and we'll come back.
Well, we're back, and it's like some mics. It's 17 and a half, I think, is Danielle Comeau, and I'm Elizabeth, and we're speaking about discos and the functions of discos. What are discos, what kind of social progress did discos and their environment and make, really, on the scene, in the urban scene, really?
Well, when you talk about disco music, I mean, you have to look at a whole bunch of different strains, different things that were happening at the same time in the late 60s and early 70s that worked towards, A, producing this, I mean, which is an innovation in terms of musical style or genre, and it's also just the way that it's reorganized the music industry, but also the way that it had a function of creating this whole new way of social interaction around music. Well, perhaps not a whole new way, but the emergence of, I mean, there have always been dance clubs, but the emergence of certain kinds of discotheques, discos in the early 70s proved to be really interesting in terms of different sorts of communities that it served. I'm thinking the post-Stonewall gay liberation movement, which made it possible for, particularly I'm talking about gay men now, made it possible for gay men to get together and socialize, you know, in public, or not public, but certainly bars that were a bit more open than than earlier gay bars, which were sort of à la cachette, sort of hidden, you know, and always susceptible to getting raided by the police. And so there was this new kind of community that was emerging, one that was a lot more political and a lot more open. And the disco functioned as a place for people to meet, to cruise, to do all kinds of things that they really weren't able to do in a more open way beforehand. And the thing that's really interesting about this is how racially mixed these places were, and how the music of choice became, like I said before, a more black and Latin-derived sound of music. And discos functioned as a real important, I think, site in terms of the development of a gay community and of a kind of black and gay urban identity.
So it was a new sort of cultural site. I mean, people went there. It's a new urban experience. You have this revolving silver ball with many tiered little mirrors flashing, mm-hmm. and sort of this Saturday Night Fever with this lit floor from beneath that flashes.
Well, actually, I think disco balls, I think, were around before the 1970s, but they were sort of, I mean, in dance clubs before that. But it was the music that made the experience different. It was a different kind of music. It was a music like we were talking about before that was just loaded with sexuality and sexual energy, and just at the level of the way the music was structured. It's the kind of music that just built tension over throughout the night. It just built and built and built, and people sort of, I mean, some people say that disco music was all about transcendence, that it would build you up to this fever pitch, and that you'd have this moment of transcendence on the dance floor, and you like have poppers up your nose and what have you, and that this was a really, in a way, a very empowering experience, and it was also a way to sort of transcend the oppression you face every day of your life as whatever it be it black or gay or what have you, and that they serve a really positive function in that way.
Well, how did the music build people up? Could you sort of define in musical terms the beat of disco itself? How would you analyze that?
Well, disco music is based on kind of black polyrhythmic structures, which are very, very, I mean, in terms of white people, we've always viewed these sort of African polyrhythms as very sexual kinds of rhythms. And so there's that aspect of the music that's very erotically charged, this sort of, and the idea, another thing that comes from the sort of black musical tradition, the idea of the chorus and the chants and the repeated phrases chanted over and over again, which became a very important element of the way disco music was structured. If you just think about most disco songs, you know, often there weren't that many lyrics, and that the vocal tracks just became part of the overall musical tracks, that they became more instrumental rather than the focus of attention. Although in some cases, like with the disco chanteuse, you know, like the Donna Summer or the Thelma Houston, her voice became a very the focus of attention in many ways. And the things that she was singing about, the transience of love, the you know, all these numbers of fleeting contacts that you have, sexual contacts that you have, you know, touch me in the morning because I'll be gone, blah, 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 all that sort of thing, I think really appealed to particularly a gay male urban culture from the early 70s, you know, this idea of fleeting contacts and the fact that love doesn't last and all that sort of thing. So that in a way also became a real focus and something that really appealed.
Or quite nonsensical lyrics, or deeply sexual lyrics, like "Ooh, I love to love you, baby," said so many times that they're not only nonsensical, but they become a track in themselves. As you were speaking about, they become almost a mantra throughout the music.
Yeah, the way it's the Village People work in the same way. You know, they have this like Greek chorus of, you know, gay stereotypes singing in the background, singing, just chanting, and it becomes part of the music tracks.
So it was disco taken to an extreme. In a lot of ways, it was almost self-referential disco with the Village People.
Yeah, well, in a way, it was. I mean, the fact that, with the Village People, you see the emergence of something that, the beginnings of something that became very prominent in the late 80s and 90s, and that's the emergence of the producer as star. I mean, Jacques Morali, the producer of the Village People, the sound became associated with the producer, and I mean, he basically put together this group of people, and you see that, you saw that with people like Giorgio Moroder, where there was a very specific sound associated with specific producers, and that's the case now with dance music, where like when I buy dance music, I often buy it based on who's produced it, you know, or who's remixed it. like a David Morales mix or a Shep Pettibone mix or what have you, and that you saw the emergence of that at the time in the 70s, this the producer as star and a producer being associated with a particular sound or a particular style of mixing or a particular style of miking. Or
so through technological means, really the producer became the artist for disco.
In a lot of ways, because disco became, before disco, music wasn't nearly as highly produced as it became with disco. I mean, in the late 60s, you're talking about four-track recording. By 1967, by 1977, you're talking 48-track, multi-track recording, all kinds of new reverb and EQing techniques and much, much better mics and a lot more knowledge on how to mic different instruments and separation of sounds and incredible orchestration, the emergence of synthesizers and all that kind of stuff being used in the production of music. So in the 70s, and with disco music, I mean directly out of disco music, you had all these incredible technical innovations which just made the music a whole different experience, just from the level of music itself. So for all these different reasons, I mean, cultural and social and economic, disco was a whole new experience for all kinds of different people. And when you say that it emerged out of this sort of black urban gay context, I mean, which you might want to see as a very marginal sort of thing. I mean, by 1975, 1976, disco was selling like 60 million records a year. I mean, it was a $4 billion a year industry. It became the dominant musical style of the 70s, and it's, to me, profoundly ironic that a music that is really very black and Latin sounding and very sexual and very homoerotic in its sort of outlook is, for it to become so incredibly popular, is profoundly ironic.
But it gave back much more than people imagined that it could in so many ways. I mean, we're deriving a lot of our images now from disco. What about the disco sucks ideology? Why did you think that came
well,
about?
Well, Dave Marsh, who is like the you know, guru of writing about rock music, the Rolling Stone correspondent, et cetera, et cetera, he believes that, he wrote that one of the main reasons why there was this big backlash against disco is that, precisely for the reasons that it was too sexual, too gay, and too black, it was profoundly threatening to 18 to 35 year old white straight men, and that's one of the reasons why I think you saw such a profound and visceral hatred. I mean, you had people, you had stadiums of people burning disco records, you know, and you had all these FM radio stations, you know, having these disco destruction armies, and I mean, these people will tell you, oh, well, they hate disco music, or they hated disco music because it was too produced, you know, it was just too slick and too produced, and discotheques were replacing live music, and that may have been the case, or it may not have been the case, but I think that you can't deny the fact that the music was really just full of all kinds of interesting things with regards to race and sexuality and gender.
So they were threatened more, perhaps, of its interracial disco floor beat. People getting together and gyrating regardless of gender, sexual preference, or color.
Yeah, I think that was one of the things that was really threatening about it, and that's one of the things that really spawned this disco sucks movement. I mean, it was mostly, demographically, 18 to 35-year-old white straight boys who were part of this disco sucks thing, and it was really sort of championed by FM radio stations whose sort of ideology at the time was playing album-oriented rock, you know, the sort of wank-off kind of
the Metallica.
ELP, yeah. And Yes, and all these sort people who thought they were big artists, mm-hmm. and, you know, making
were
big artistic statements.
Electronically produced, perhaps.
Oh, well, highly produced. It's the whole thing. I mean, I don't really think that ELP or Yes or whoever are, you know, the best kind of band to see live. I'd much rather see Donna Summer live. And that's another thing is some of these big disco acts were able to pack. I mean, it wasn't just recorded music. I mean, Donna Summer used to play to 35,000 seat stadiums. So it wasn't so much that disco was not a performing kind of musical style. I mean, it was. I mean, the big stars did perform. In fact, up and coming disco singers would often perform in gay and black clubs, you know, in small clubs. So it's not so much that it was displacing live music. I mean, the very fact of music being recorded at all began a long time ago with music first being recorded, and that's what I think the fact that music is recorded and reproduced starts replacing the fact that it's being performed live.
Well, it's 7:30, so it's time for a musical
break.
Jinx, I've got you. And we're with Danielle Comeau. I'm Elizabeth. This is Dykes on Mics, 90.3 FM, CKUT. And this is for all the women who are wearing their Walkmans in closets with their doors closed, listening to this show. We're saying hello to you today. And this is the disco show.
Pretend it's 1978, and you're straight. Your best buddy calls you up one night and says, man, I really miss you. We haven't hung out in a long time. Let's go out tonight to a party, to a disco. Yeah, sounds like a great idea. I just broke up with that Playboy bunny. I busted open her lips. She split town. Come by around town. Shoot the shit. Have some brewski. Sounds cool. He comes over. You're catching up on old times, having some laughs. Get ready to go out. Put on a pair of khaki pants, topsiders, Brooks Brothers shirt. Go downstairs to get in his car. Man, you got a Camaro? You're doing great. Then you start driving around town, and he gets kind of quiet, really introverted. Keeps fixing his hair in the rearview mirror and driving down some dark alleys you've never been down before. He pulls up to the bumper, jumps out of the car, slams the door, runs up the stairs to this big warehouse. So you walk up behind him, and you're standing around looking inside. You don't see any girls. Wait a minute, maybe you do. There's a couple dancing together, short hair, flannel shirts, big fat asses. Not your kind of girls. So you mosey on over to the bar, and you're leaning there drinking a beer, and all of a sudden this guy starts walking towards you in a real, real tight pair of five-button Levi's. Yellowing tank top, handlebar mustache, red bandana hanging out of his left pocket. He says, I'd like to buy you a beer. Yeah, well, I've got one already. At this point, your best buddy has disappeared. Thanks a lot, man. Then the guy pulls out a little bottle and shoves them up underneath your nose. They're poppers. You never smelled them before, and you start to get kind of nervous and dizzy and sexy and hot and sweaty and into the rhythm. And you walk out to the dance floor with, but inside your head it keeps echoing, but I'm straight, man. I'm straight. I'm straight. Somebody hands you a tambourine. Suddenly, in the corner of the disco, you see a big black man and a gold LeMay countdown looming above the crowd. Here's a short line.
They lived only to bathe in the music, in each other's desire, in a strange democracy whose only ticket of admission was physical beauty, and not even that sometimes. It was a democracy such as the world, with its rewards and penalties, its competition, its snobbery, never permits, but which flourished in that little room on the 12th floor of a factory building on West 33rd Street, because its central principle was the most anarchic of all, erotic love. Now that's Andrew Holleran writing in one of the first novels to chronicle the sort of gay disco scene in the 70s. He's talking right now, it's published in 78, but he's talking about 1971 when, after Stonewall, when these gay discos started popping up everywhere. And that just gives you an idea of this sort of strange Netherland that was the gay disco, and what sort of things that were happening there, that it was completely different, that the what was important, what fueled desire was just completely different from what you saw in other areas of the culture.
And another area of the culture in the 70s, which is relating particularly to women, is a resurgence of women's voices, women's movement, women's music, which was quite particular in terms of the whiteness of it, and as we were talking about before, the anti-sexness of it.
Well, yeah, I mean, if you're wondering, you know, I'm talking about disco, and I think when I say gay, I mean mostly gay men. You're probably wondering, where were the women? Well, actually, there were a lot of women around, but mostly they were sort of, I mean, in the early 70s, these discos afforded just your average woman the ability to go out by herself. I mean, I know it's hard to fathom for anybody who's under the age of 30, but there were a time when it was really hard for women to go out to clubs, nightclubs, restaurants by themselves without a date, without, like, a boy on her arm. And discos afforded women, single women, the ability to go out by themselves, you know, and dance by themselves if they so desired. But I think what was happening at the same time, I mean, we're talking about the post-Stonewall gay liberation. Well, there was the parallel women's movement at the time, and coming out, I mean, it was a whole different politics and a whole different sensibility, and the music and culture that came out of that was completely different from disco. I mean, what was happening with women's, I think with the women's culture, I don't want to sort of make blanket statements, but I think what was more happening was turning in on ourselves, separating ourselves from a popular culture, separating ourselves from, I guess, what was called mainstream culture, and trying to come up with alternative women's music networks and women's music, you know, the whole Olivia Records thing, and that there was really no place, I think, for dykes in this disco culture, not a really big place. I mean, the whole politics of the early 70s for lesbians in particular, I mean, I use the word lesbians in a sort of historical way. I don't use the word lesbian to describe myself now, but it's more of a historical term. I prefer the word queer or dyke for political reasons.
And that's just a personal aside, but...
That's a personal aside. And I think that's, in a way, it's kind of unfortunate. Not unfortunate, I think it's an important part of politicization and what happens with popular movements in general, where there's a initial element of separation that allows you to separate it from other people, especially if you're in a position of suffering oppression. I mean, you can see the same thing in the sort of Black Power movement in Britain, where there's this time of separation where you just sort of work on a positive self-image and building up a very positive alternative identity to the one that's been placed on you by dominant culture. But I think after a certain amount of time, you have to break out of that you have to move on and become more integrative in your approach. And I think that's what has happened with feminist politics and theory, and that's what's happened with Black politics and post-colonial writing, and that's in a way what's happened, I think, with a lot of gay men too, is this attempt to sort of bridge gaps between various communities. But when you're talking the early 70s, you're talking real separation.
Mm-hmm.
And I think politics has come a long way since then, in that we're really bridging gaps and have a more overall integrative approach to politics.
And you've described something as the young urban dyke, to maybe describe, you know, something of the 1990s, and taking elements of pop culture and cobbling them together,
yes,
to form an identity. And I wrote that down because I thought that was a really good way of describing it.
Well, that's how when I was writing this paper on gay disco, one of the things that I thought about was the ways in which gay men have always taken, and this is way before Stonewall, this is like 50s and 60s, the way that gay men have taken various images and people and music, art, or whatever, things from the popular, and cobbled together in what became known as the sort of camp sensibility, a radical new identity, a gay identity. And I think that's what these gay urban dykes, like most of my friends, do. They take not things that are, you know, outrightly say, I am gay, I am a dyke, whatever, but just take things, even things that are really politically incorrect, things out of popular culture, like the whole cult around supermodels. I mean, all the young dykes I know love the supermodels, know who they are, know what they've done, and, you know, all that kind of thing, and in a way, take these sort of things and, I mean, take that and use it as a way of forming a new kind of radical dyke identity.
Uh-huh. And it's taking elements that, taking elements from... the supermodel thing, I'm just curious now, in terms of... That's a particular discourse. I'm not sure if everybody necessarily knows exactly what you mean by supermodel.
Oh, well, supermodels are the most popular models in the world. Cover girls, models, runway models, the people who model clothes appear on the cover of Vogue. And there are always, at any given time, a handful of models who are the highest paid, most popular. Their faces are everywhere. And you just know who they are because their faces are everywhere. They're not just on magazine covers, but they're throughout television. And you just sort of get to know who they are. And, you know, they become, there's a sort of cult of personality around supermodels. And I think, in a way, the way that they portray their gender identities and their sexualities is almost a kind of performance. They're uh-huh. often hyper feminine, uh-huh. and I think that's really appealing in a way to people who are by their very nature of being self-avowed gay or dyke or whatever, have a consciousness about identity and about gender and sexuality, and know that gender is not something that's fixed and prescribed. That is something that's constructed, and that you can play with it yourself, that you can construct, you can do various things with gender identity and sexuality yourself, and it becomes a kind of performance. It's like all the dykes who are obsessed with James Dean, I mean, dress like James Dean, act like James Dean. At that point, it becomes a kind of performance, a gender performance, where at the one level, you've got, like, on an anatomical level, you've got, like, a female body, which maybe has a particular kind of gender identity, should be feminine, but is a dyke as well, and then starts parading around like this hermaphrodite. I mean, you just got all these different things happening, and it's really, really interesting.
What are there any other... Would you feel comfortable in describing maybe places that young urban dykes are? From where are they cobbling things together? You mentioned the supermodels.
Oh, everywhere. Advertising, I mean, television. Television is a big source of these things. I mean, yeah. You've got... you know, this huge, huge number of dykes that watch L.A. Law because there's this, like, bisexual character who is... And her sexuality is never really outrightly stated. It's only ever played with in a very subtle, surface kind of way. But now you've got this huge dyke following that watches L.A. Law religiously because, you know...
It has, yes.
And you see that. You see it happening more and more on TV, this idea of playing with gender and sexuality, not in any kind of radical way, but I think these things get taken up. You've got, you know, of course, things like Madonna and Sandra Bernhardt. I mean, but they're different because they self-consciously, I think, try to play with these notions of not a fixed gender identity.
Presenting that something more ambiguous and...
Either more ambiguous or that, yeah, that has more possibilities, that is self-consciously has more possibilities, and sort of a nod and a wink to people who know the codes. That, you know, this is what's going on, that when Madonna appropriates Vogue, I mean, we all know what voguing's about. It's about black and Latino men, you know, trying to be as real as possible, being whatever it is that they're trying to be it supermodels. I mean, that's one of the big, big roles, one of the big categories at the Vogue balls was supermodels and, you know, different kinds of drag, be it army drag or corporate drag or what have you. So, I mean, it just comes from music, mm-hmm. There's certain...
Videos.
I mean, anything that's... Any aspect of popular culture, I think, can... It ends up, at some point, being possibly taken up and made part. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it's not like in the past, I think, where it... You know, there was this real element of political correctness where you could only like certain things, and you only liked things because... they were bi women, or they had a correct political line, or what have you. I think things have become a lot more subtle and a lot more diverse now.
Yeah, I think that probably sums it up. That's exactly it, I think. When we were referring to the 70s women's movement, I think, again, as a generality, it was outright rejection of anything patriarchal and a redefining of women's space. And so naturally it took on separatist sort of tones, whereas now there's any number of women, of lesbians, who will call themselves feminists and lesbians, but the categories are enormous.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think what happened a lot in some earlier and even some present feminist theories falling into the same traps of binarisms in terms of gender and sexuality, where, you know, there was no questioning this sort of male-female kind of binarism, in that it was just a reversal and just trying to privilege female qualities and this sort of things that are essentially quote-unquote essentially female, which I think was really problematic. But I also think that the possibilities were really rigid compared to, I think now, that in terms of sexuality, I don't know, I just find a lot of early feminist writing to be pretty anti-sex, and that this has become a really important part of the young urban dyke and the way that she mm-hmm. Deals with the world around her.
I guess that was part of the process. And now it's 1991. And we're going to go to a musical break.